Good evening. You're listening to On Blast with the Philadelphia Student Union on WPEB 88.1 FM. We're your hosts for today's show. I'm Katora, senior at University City High School.
And I'm Dylan, junior at Kappa. The Student Union is a youth-led organization. We are a group of young people from Philadelphia Public Schools making changes in the world and the school system, doing political education and leadership development.
On Blast is the only youth-led and youth-produced radio show in Philadelphia. That means that students do the interviews, edit, and produce segments, and we host the show. We are using the media as a tool to organize and liberate young people.
You can tune into On Blast every Wednesday from 6 to 7 p.m. on 88.1 FM, WPEB. Or you can also listen to the show online by going to our podcast at onblast.podomatic.com. While you are there, you can also subscribe to our podcast and have new shows sent directly to your iTunes.
Today, we're here experts of a conversation with School Reform Commissioner member Heidi Ramirez about teacher quality and the school district strategic plan.
We also have a piece exploring the troubled past of the West Virginia coal mining industry. And we'll hear Willie Baptist, a longtime organizer in the movement to end poverty, talk about his experience working with his Kensington Welfare Rights Union here in Philadelphia. Plus, we'll have music and other news.
Last week, Secretary of Education Arne Duncan and Reverend Al Sharpton and former House Speaker Newt Gingrich came to our city as a part of their listening and learning tour regarding a national agenda for public education reform. In the weeks leading up to the visit, the Philadelphia Student Union, PSU, sent several requests for the trip to meet with those who would be most affected by the reform they plan to implement. We got no response from Secretary Arne Duncan or Reverend Al Sharpton, and we were left wondering who the group was really listening to, since none of us were included in the tour agenda. We were only able to speak with them through a locked and guarded fence. Azeem brings us the story.
On Tuesday, September 29th, Secretary of Education Arne Duncan, the Reverend Al Sharpton, and former Speaker of the House Newt Gingrich kicked off a national tour called the Listening and Learning Tour in Philadelphia. They visited a Mastery Charter School in West Philadelphia and McDaniel Elementary School in South Philadelphia. Here's Superintendent Arlene Ackerman opening up the ceremony.
We believe that children come first, that parents are our partners, that victories in the classroom, that leadership and accountability are the keys to our success, and it takes the entire community to educate our public children in our public schools.
The Philadelphia Student Union, Youth United for Change, Education Not Incarceration, the Parent School and Community Partnership, Philadelphia ACORN, the Southeastern Pennsylvania Network, the United Taxi Workers Alliance, Parents United, and others representing thousands of students, parents, and families heard about this tour and saw it was a great opportunity to have our leaders listen to what we think our schools need to be a part of this national conversation. Our groups requested a meeting of both Duncan and Sharpton several times prior to the start of the tour. We did not hear anything back, so we decided to try to attend a press conference at the parking lot of McDaniel Elementary that was scheduled for 2:15 p.m. This timing made it very hard for students and parents to attend. Our plan was to try to talk to the two men and ask them to meet with us at another time. When we arrived at McDaniel Elementary, we were told that the press conference had been moved inside and no one from the public was allowed in. We waited for the press conference to be over outside the gate of the school because we could not even approach the doors. When Duncan and Sharpton came outside, we had no choice but to try to get their attention. This is what happened.
I'm asking you, could you meet with students at another time?
Not just sure,
make
with
perfect
us.
Time
sure,
for us.
But whatever you want to say it for, say now.
But we don't have all students in Philadelphia opinion.
Exactly.
We don't have our
okay.
on ours. We're not asking to meet with all of them, but we're looking to meet with a group of them.
We would love to do that. We would love to do
when?
That.
When?
We'll figure that out. But could you tell me what we could do to help you?
I didn't understand what was the point of having a listen and learning tour if you guys didn't visit any of my, didn't my high school, none of my high schools in my community.
How many high schools do you have in Philadelphia?
It was hard talking to Duncan and Sharpton through a fence. If this was a listening and learning tour, we wondered, who are they listening to? For the most part, the roundtable discussion that happened before the press conference included elected officials and district officials, not students or parents. In our opinion, a civil rights activist like Al Sharpton should have made it his business to find out who was organizing around public education before he got to Philadelphia. Students, parents, and community members have a lot to add to discussions around national education reform. Here in Philadelphia, we've been a part of a historic privatization experiment since 2001. We've learned about how not to impose school reform on our community. Are the two schools the tour visited in Philadelphia good models of what we want education reform in our country to look like? One of the things that students want to make sure of is that schools train students to be critical thinkers, not test takers. We are tired of being told that we are just competing with students across the globe. We are ready to join students across the globe. At Student Union, we believe that students need a more realistic education where kids learn how to critically think and not compete, but build a better global economy that suits our needs. Ultimately, we got Duncan and Sharpton to agree to meeting with us. Now we have to hold them accountable today. This is Azeem Hill with the Philadelphia Student Union signing off.
What can a brother do for me? brother, 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 brother. Oh, I know sometimes you need me, and I got your back. Oh, cause I know you got mine, cause you're my brother, brother, brother. And I love you, love you, love you, love you. Count on me, K-Star, Reese, and G. Yes, you are my brother, brother. All right. Oh, my brother, brother, brother. Oh, my brother, now. We laid up at night. We need a helping hand. Here's your brother. Oh, I'm talking about my brother. All across the world. My brother, she.
We just heard a piece about Al Sharpton and Secretary of Education Arne Duncan coming to Philly. They both committed to meeting with PSU sometime soon. On Blast will be sure to cover the meeting when it happens.
With help from Media Mobilizing Project, PSU also produced a video piece called From the Other Side of the Fence. It has footage of the closed-door press conference and confrontation that followed it. You can watch it at MediaMobilizing.org.
Up next, our interview with Heidi Ramirez.
The School Reform Commission, or SRC, is the governing board of the Philadelphia School District. Philadelphia Student Union members often testify at SRC meetings because we want the district to take our voices into account. One SRC member who we think has really listened to us is Heidi Ramirez, who is also the director of the Urban Education Collaborative at Temple University. We recently had a chance to interview her. The first question we asked her is how we can get highly qualified teachers at all city schools.
Well, I think first it's really understanding what the problems and challenges are. I'm generally telling folks that there are a lot of myths around teacher quality, that in fact, as a state, we do not have a teacher shortage. Pennsylvania is a state that actually trains or prepares more teachers than it needs. However, we tend to not have teachers in the right areas, meaning we do not train enough teachers in math and science. We could be training more teachers to serve second language learners, secondary students in special education, etc. So there's always this little catch of you can be a certified teacher, but you might be certified in math who is now asked to teach physics. So there's a challenge in terms of, one, making sure we prepare enough teachers in the right content areas. Two, making sure that all teachers, regardless of their content specialization, are prepared to serve diverse populations. And then I would say there's the challenge of recruiting them and retaining them in our particularly neediest schools. Right now, particularly in Philadelphia, there's a real disparity in terms of teacher quality across the district, meaning there are some schools where 100% of the teachers are what we would define as highly qualified, and some where it's 50% or lower.
We also asked how we can retain these teachers.
I think when you look at how teachers describe sort of the issues that keep them in schools or that drive them from, a lot of it has to do with the quality of school leadership. A lot has to do with the overall climate of the school and whether or not they feel that they have professional colleagues who can support their continuing development. They want to be in safe schools, schools that are resourced well. So there are all of those kinds of things that we can do to make each building a better place for each teacher. And then there are the set of things we should be doing overall to make sure that each teacher is developing his or her craft. So I think having folks whose job it is, or see as their job, to support teachers, to observe classrooms, to provide feedback, classrooms where other teachers can observe and see models of exemplary practice, opportunities for teachers to meet in grade-level groups to talk about what is or is not working, what challenges they have, data that can help them really look at individual student needs and then replan their instructional practice to match those student needs.
Earlier this year, the school district put into place a strategic plan called Imagine 2014. It gained a lot of attention in the media, and many people had different views on it. We at the Philadelphia Student Union supported many aspects of the plan, such as adding more counselors, reducing class sizes, and hiring teachers earlier in the year. On the other hand, we felt that the plan lacked some specifics, especially relating to implementation and costs. We also felt that some parts of the plan opened the door for hiring private managers to take over schools.
I would say I think the strength of the plan certainly is its ambition, that they are really sort of, it's a comprehensive plan and that it really touches on a variety of different areas in student lives, the lives of teachers and other education professionals. So that is exciting. I certainly think it expects us to do an awful lot with some limited resources, but I think that is the place we are in. We need to be thinking boldly. What I have heard from community members is that folks would like more specifics so they can see how they can be engaged in the work. And I think as a commissioner, more specific so that I could better understand the specific needs that we have, sort of an assessment of needs so that we're able to prioritize among all of these ambitious ideas, prioritize which of them makes the most sense to be implementing now at this time with the resources we have. And then, of course, understanding what the budget implications are so that we can help prioritize if we know what things cost and we know and expect we'll have to make some difficult decisions over the next year or two. Having that information will help us all make better sense of it. And then I think we had a good degree of input from the community in laying out this as a framework. I think engaging the community is a next step in really thinking about the implementation of it.
Imagine 2014 is a 5-year plan. We were curious as to what we can expect to see starting this fall.
Well, I think you can already see some parts of it in place now and continuing to expand. So, for instance, we have seen over the last 6 months certainly an increase in a variety of resources to our lowest performing schools. So a whole set of what I describe as sort of wraparound services, increased counselors, parent ombudsman, a pressure to reduce class size in these schools. So a host of those things are already underway. I think you're seeing already some activity and efforts to engage the community in thinking about what Dr. Ackerman has described as renaissance schools. I think there are also efforts underway to really improve both teacher quality and leadership development.
Imagine 2014 calls for the turnaround of some of the district's struggling schools to be called renaissance schools. One of the proposed options is a model called an in-district charter school. The district uses somewhat vague language when referring to this idea. We have been wondering if there are any more specifics and if community groups might be able to influence the model.
Again, I would say this is probably in that you asked earlier sort of where did I think the strategic plan could improve, and one of my responses was around being more specific, and I think this is an area where I think there are terms that are used throughout the plan that probably have different meanings for different folks or don't have any meaning for some people. So I can't yet speak myself to sort of what is meant by in-district charters. I think that's something the district is beginning to develop a vision around. But again, particularly around our lowest performing schools, I think that's where we should and I hope will engage the community, both in terms of input, in terms of the design of these things, but also in implementing.
Now that she has resigned from the SRC, we asked her how she plans to stay involved with schools in Philadelphia.
I'm still thinking about that. I should say right now that my tenure on the School Reform Commission is not complete yet. I will continue my work at Temple University, and then we'll see what other opportunities and adventures present themselves. I should add that I have developed an extraordinary set of relationships with folks in the community over the last 2 years, and I hope those continue in whatever sort of professional or volunteer role that I am privileged to play. Well, if I can just say one other thing, then it really is, and I said this a bit in the interview, was how special the community has been to me and how much I appreciate that. And that is very true. I appreciate the opportunity the governor and mayor and the community has given me. And among those, I think we often don't pay enough tribute to the youth groups that are part of that. And so, since I'm at the Philadelphia Student Union as we speak, and you really have been an active and engaged community partner with the district for a long time, I want to thank you and, of course, your colleagues and other organizations.
You have just listened to a shortened version of our interview with Heidi Ramirez. The entire interview includes more about her views on teacher quality and Imagine 2014, as well as a discussion about what she thinks the role of the SRC should be and how our expectations compare to her experiences. To hear the entire interview, go to our podcast page at onblast.podomatic.com. This has been an On Blast production with the Philadelphia Student Union. I'm Gregory Jordan Dedemore. Zakia Royster, Javier Morris, and Azeem Hill also participated in this interview.
Stay tuned for more on Blast after this short music break.
OC episode, actress, mattress, newest sunglasses, rock star classes, backstage passes. Thought I told you she would mold you. Mind she hold you like crazy glue. No crew, so cool. Tell me what you gonna do.
She run, 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 you she run, run.
We just heard a piece about key issues facing the Philadelphia School District. Now let's get some news about the ongoing struggle to keep Casino out of Philadelphia.
On Tuesday, September 29th, Casino Free Philadelphia held a demonstration in front of the Sugar House Casino construction site on Delaware Avenue. It was organized with one clear goal in mind. We are ready to bankrupt Sugar House and its predatory accomplices before they bankrupt us. David McKenna, a spokesperson for Casino Free Philadelphia, said, "We've shown Neil Bloom and Sugar House and their friends in Harrisburg that we're prepared to do whatever we need to do in order to stop these casinos. We're here to defend our city against a predatory industry, and we're only getting stronger. As far as we know, this is the first action of this kind at a casino construction site. But we know it won't be the last. We'll keep fighting until Neil Bloom and Sugar House pull up stakes and get out of our city." 14 of the protesters of ages 20 to 70 and from all parts of the city sat down and blocked the gate to the construction site. They were soon arrested one by one and taken to the police station. They were charged with failure to disperse, defiant trespass, and disorderly conduct. They were all later released.
The demonstrators were there for a number of reasons. The two proposed casinos, Sugar House and Foxwood, were forced upon Philadelphia by the state several years ago, largely against the wishes of Philadelphia residents. People are worried that the presence of casinos will lead to gambling addiction and disrupt both the surrounding neighborhoods and city as a whole. In particular, people feel that casinos are targeting poor people and families. At the demonstration, some people spoke from personal experience about the effects that gambling have on families. Also, people are worried that casinos will bring more crime and hurt local businesses. Having secured finances for project, Sugar House executives say that they are ready to begin construction very soon. A groundbreaking ceremony is supposed to take place on Thursday, October the 8th, although it will not be open to the public. Construction and initial building is scheduled to take 10 months. The facility is expected to hold 1,700 slot machines and will sit on Delaware Riverfront in Fishtown and North Liberties. Anti-casino activists have been able to hold off the construction of the casinos for several years now and intend to continue their efforts. See CasinoFreePhila.org for more information and updates.
Up next, a segment about trouble past the West Virginia coal mines.
In the summer of 2009, students from the Philadelphia Student Union and other organizing groups from Philadelphia took a trip to West Virginia. There, they attended a leadership institute with groups from the U.S. and abroad that are working to end poverty. At the leadership institute, the groups attended workshops and took trips to observe how the coal industry affected the people of West Virginia. On one of the trips, they met with Wes Harris, who is a local historian and a former coal miner. Wes Harris gave a tour of Matewan, West Virginia, the site of previous mine worker strikes that took place in the 1920s. There, he explained the conditions of coal minings before they were unionized.
In 1905, okay, and as a general rule of thumb, about 1905, everything north of the Kanawha River was largely United Mine Worker coal. It was union coal. Everything south were non-union. This is an American silver dollar. A union miner got paid that, all right? Almost 7/10 of an ounce of real silver. Good anywhere in the world. If you were south of the river, this is a piece of scrip. It's a piece of tin with a hole in it. Good only at the company store. That's what they got paid.
Workers were paid with coins called scrips that could be used at the company store. At the company store, products were more expensive as opposed to a regular store. When miners were not able to afford food or clothes at the company store, they would charge it on credit that could only be paid off by working more. Purchases led to debt. Debt led to more working as well as more purchases. It created a cycle that led to a system of slavery. Because if workers stopped working, then the result would be debt.
The whole story that we would tell you today can be understood right here. When the railroads came into southern West Virginia, into these mountains, that meant the slave coal could now be shipped north to Pittsburgh to compete with the union coal. The union has to either move south or die, because the northern operators basically said, why would we pay you real money when we could pay those guys down there a piece of tin, okay?
Mine workers north of the Kanawha River knew they would lose their jobs if they did not help the workers south of the Kanawha River to unionize.
That's what the whole fight. You hear about the mine wars?
Yeah.
I don't talk about the mine wars anymore. We used to do that. Put this in your brain. It's the West Virginia Mine War, 1890 to the present. We have a lot of battles, but it's one war, and it goes on today, and today we're in what I call the ethnic cleansing phase. Appalachians are no longer needed, and we're being run out of our homeland. That's what's happening here.
Workers attempting to unionize had many difficulties. On a map, Wes Harris showed the only two towns not owned by the coal companies.
And down here at Esdale, this other circle on Cabin Creek, were the only two non-company towns. So that meant if you lived anywhere else, if you got evicted for joining the union, you had to go to Holly Grove or Paint Creek and pitch a tent to live. You got evicted from your company house 5 minutes after they found out you were in the union. On Cabin Creek, they'd say, hit the creek. That meant we own the land on either side. Get your feet in that water and walk. Company town, the company owned the houses, the school, the churches, and all that. They had what was called a shack rouster. The shack rouster would go along at 5 o'clock in the morning if there's no light in your house. He'd beat on the door to get up and go to work. If you didn't get up, the shack rouster had a key. He went into your house, kicked you out of bed. You said, I'm sick. The shack rouster said, let's take you to company doctor. The company doctor said, well, you didn't have any trouble walking here to see me. You go back to work.
The struggle of the coal workers remains unknown to many.
The scrip system would go on as late as 1970. We still had scrip being used in West Virginia. It was essentially gutted or diluted by the end of the 1940s. And there had been some court decisions that said the coal companies had to be willing to trade scrip for real money. Here in West Virginia, we had over 500 separate kinds of money. Now, if you go to our new state museum, a $17 million one up in Charleston, they make out like scrip was a favor. I have yet to interview a single descendant or a single worker from those times who thought scrip was anything but bad. So it was simply a way of control, a mechanism of control.
The coal workers' fight to unionize was long and hard and still continues today.
Statistically speaking, we could reduce by 70% all coal mine fatalities tomorrow morning without spending a dime. All we would have to do is make every mine in this country union.
The struggle of the coal miners and their fight relates a lot to what's going on in Philadelphia with students. The way the coal companies operated allowed the workers very few options. It maintained a system so that companies remained in control and the workers had no choice but to comply. Take the scrips, for example. They were a worthless piece of currency used to assure that workers would need credit in order to purchase necessities, which would lead to debt, which would keep workers powerless and out of control. The system is in some ways very similar to the Philadelphia School District. By not supplying students with necessary resources to succeed in school, such as books and qualified teachers, this prevents students from excelling to their full potential. But like the coal miners, students also form unions to stand together and be stronger to fight for rights. For instance, we, the Philadelphia Student Union, fight for equal education for our students in both magnet and neighborhood schools. I'm Kimora Lamott, and I produced this segment, and it was edited by Matthew Johnson. For On Blast of the Philadelphia Student Union.
Coming up in a few minutes, we'll hear Willie Baptist speak about his work with the Kensington Welfare Rights Union. But first, let's hear some music.
Last summer, Philadelphia Student Union participated in a leadership institute in West Virginia put on by the Poverty Scholars Program of Union Theological Seminary in Harlem. While there, we got the chance to sit down with Willie Baptist, a longtime organizer and leader in the movement to end poverty. I asked him about his experiences working with the Kensington Welfare Rights Union in Philadelphia.
Well, I came to the Kensington Welfare Rights Union out of almost a 10-year period of involvement with the Homeless Union, national organizing drive. It's an organization of poor and homeless families, mainly welfare mothers. I was the education director for 10 years there. It's being based in Kensington gave it a multiracial character, much more class character, you know, because it didn't look like an all-black or all people of color. It had poor whites. Because Kensington itself, at that time, was basically one-third poor white, one-third poor Latino, and one-third African-American. And there was a growing Asian community. And Kensington was the poorest community in Philadelphia, still is, in the whole state, as a matter of fact. The fact that people were really hurting around problems of housing and food and so on was a tremendous compulsion for us to come together. The influence that surrounded us operated against our unity in a certain respect. But, you know, we maintain an approach where we identified what we had in common and then fought it out on that basis, you know. Like, for example, when I was homeless, we set up a tent city right there, Cecil B. Moore and American Street, and we had about upwards of 50-something families who had set up a makeshift shack. We named it after our illustrious governor at that stage. His name was Ridgeville. We had there, man, you know, a mixture, you know. And we had a guy named Paul. Turns out he was from Pottstown. And he was also a member of the Klan, had been a member of the Klan. So he's sitting off and of course, the black welfare moms and the Puerto Rican moms, he wouldn't let nobody get close to his kids because he was just afraid, you know. But then over time, you know, us dealing with the fact that we needed food, you know, make a long story short, if you touch those, you know, African-American mothers, Latin American, you had to deal with Paul. And if you touch Paul, you had to deal with them. It was just a beautiful relationship. It's just once you get rid of that fear and really focus on what we had in common, we was able to deal with the diversity and a lot of the racial mistrust and all that kind of stuff. But those are just examples. I think another good example is when we decided to march from the tent city, Ridgeville, to Ridge's Mansion. That's what the thing, from Ridgeville to Ridge's Mansion. That was the governor's mansion in Harrisburg. We knew that the demographics of the state was such that they describe it as Philadelphia one end, Pittsburgh another, and Alabama, Mississippi in between. But we decided at that stage, because we were multiracial, we could figure out an approach, tactical approach, in our march across the state, or toward the middle of the state. So we decided that we would only have our white executive director, who happened to be white, to speak, and I wouldn't be the spokesperson. And that was a good tactic. It recognized those racial fears, and through that, it was able to not have what we were doing to be construed as a inner city Philadelphia black thing, you know? And as a consequence, was able to recruit, as we all along the way, and when we went to Harrisburg, Latinos, blacks, all kinds of people by that tactic. In fact, we found in the area, in the vicinity of Harrisburg, something like 9 encampments, man, mainly poor whites. And the militia, which was in, at that stage, it was kind of this kind of right-wing militia group, they were trying to recruit the veterans from the Gulf War. And the veterans was dealing with the same issues that we was dealing with. And they joined up with us, you know, in our fight, because they were fighting over the same issues. They had fought a war. They were veterans. They wasn't getting their benefits, health benefits. And these are the issues that we brought to the Capitol. And we moved into the Capitol, set up beds on the floor and all that stuff, and carried out our form of lobbying for a good period of time. And we was able to capture the imagination of central Pennsylvania to the point where I had to took up command of the encampment where we were situated by the Capitol there. And in the space of an hour, there was two major groups that came to us. One was the militia, the white militia, and the other one was the black Muslims. And when the white militia come, they, you know, I happen to be in charge, so they send them over to me, and they say, look, we want to help you. We know you guys have been working with the veterans, and y'all been taking up these issues, and can we help? We said, well, what do you want to do? Well, the guy told me, I got in the vicinity, and we are organized, and we got this place surrounded. You know, we got a unit over here, a unit over there, a unit over there. And I'm hearing him. He's talking all this kind of military talk like that. And he says, anybody mess with you guys, they got to deal with us. You know, I say, cool. He said, just to give you an idea of what the real deal is, he had me talk to all the units, you know, on his little walkie-talkie. And they was all like, yes, you know, like, yeah, we're here. And then within about a half hour or so, a little more, the black Muslim guys spin out of their thing with their necktie and their little paramilitary. They come walking on and say, look, you guys deal with issues that our membership didn't deal with. And we think that it'd be good if we can have Farrakhan come out here. Because we had captured, we had captured the media, all the media. We was on radios and going to the local high schools and colleges and speaking and stuff. We had just captured people's imagination because we was just there in the Capitol building. It was all kinds of things that was generated. But the color factor or the racial factor kept coming out in those ways. And I think because we focused on these economic issues, man, that people were hurting by, I think we was able to overcome within ourselves as well as the pressures from outside, these racial cleavages or dissensions and stuff. But we had three demands. One is that there was abandoned houses, and we wanted to put homeless people that we have been meeting to work to tear down the boards, refurbish those houses at a living wage, and then move into the house. That was our housing. That was our job program. And another one was that we would set up a poor people's embassy that would monitor, you know, legislation and bills that are going through the state legislature, especially those having to do with poverty. And we needed a building, and wanted the governor to make provisions for us to be there on site. Then the third one is that we wanted to speak to the governor for real, you know, because we kept making that one of our demands. So he woke us up around 6 o'clock in the morning before the media come, and then he tried to set up and have a meeting with us. But he said, I'll meet with you, but I won't meet with, essentially, your white, you know, it was Sherry Hunkler at that stage. I won't meet with her. And he was playing the color game because he wanted to posture himself dealing with Philadelphia, these blacks. Because his constituency was mainly the middle of Pennsylvania, which is mainly white. And he knew we were cutting into that base. That's why he had to meet with us, because we were raising the issues, and the way we were raising it was such that people could see themselves in what we were raising. The fact that poverty and homelessness and all the problems, manifestation of poverty, didn't know no color, man. You know, we just had to deal with people, you know, on the basis of the issues. And realizing, you know, the kind of fear and mistrust and racial feelings and stuff like that was there. But we just kept hammering home, man, on the common and working the thing out, you know.
This has been Dan Jones from Blast Radio with the Philadelphia Student Union.
If you're just joining us, this is On Blast with the Philadelphia Student Union on WPEB 88.1 FM. You can also listen to the show online, including past shows, by going to our podcast at www.onblast.podomatic.com.
Stay tuned for more On Blast after this song.
I had no more time left to be.
You've been listening to On Blast with the Philadelphia Student Union. This is just a taste of what the student union does. We also do ongoing campaigns to improve our schools, monthly open mics, men's and women's groups, academic support, political education, and lots of other youth-led activities.
If you want more information about the Philadelphia Student Union, check out our website at www.phillystudentunion.org.
Tune in next week, Wednesday, 6 to 7 p.m. for the next edition of On Blast with the Philadelphia Student Union. You can also listen to the show online by going to our podcast at onblast.podomatic.com. See you next time.